I'd like to welcome you here to the fourth session, is it now? And this is the session where we talk about the drowning of the world, Children of Eden, the drowning of the world. Bill Moyers has called this discussion on the flood, the apocalypse. Many other people have mentioned many other things about it, but before we actually get into the text, I want to ask a question of all of you. When you think back to your childhood or your children's childhood, what sort of images come to your mind about this story called, in most books, Noah's Ark or the Flood? Do you have any memories of what it was like as for children?
Two by two.
Rainbows. Rain and shine for four days.
Yeah, okay.
And the bird coming back with the bough in its mouth.
The bird coming back, right. Okay. Did any of you remember bodies floating? Do any of you remember after the waters receded, stench, bloated, dead carcasses laying all over the place?
No.
You do?
No.
What a childhood you had.
But somewhere, and I'm trying to think of what movie it was, they didn't actually show people drowning, but the sounds of people screaming and moaning, and that was the first time I ever thought about all the people that died.
I guess John Huston's film, The Bible, where he did some of the scenes from Genesis.
And it was really disturbing.
During Lent at Holden this year, I was talking to Martin yesterday. Were any of you here that you could tell the story? They had this room become the ark. And the room became dark. Because in the ark there was only one skylight. And they started reading the story. And they had 12 people outside the ark. And as they were outside, they started screaming, "Let us in," wailing. And soon there was 11 and 10 and 9, etc., etc., until everything outside this room was silent. And Martin said to me, "I will never read this story the same again." We have children's books. This one cries. It has the ark, but everything that's in the waters are fish and whales and octopuses and turtles. There's houses here, but that's about. Yeah, this one is pretty good. I mean, I don't know if it's good. I don't know if I'd show it to my kids. But here you have a rhinoceros, an elephant, some little kids, a boy, a girl, a man. You have people trying to swim towards the last bits on the tops of the mountains here. If you want to pass that around, you can just take a look at that one. But even that one, if you look at the cover is the last page of the book. That's what you see when you come out of the ark. And I live on the Mississippi River in Minnesota. We have 10 acres. 5 acres is in the flood zone. And this year we had about 5 feet of water in that flood area. It was all woods. It was all fine for us. But the amount of debris, the amount of cleanup just in that little area, the amount of stuff that I never knew existed was there. It's not like that cover picture. Listen, I'm going to play the tape of, we're actually going to go through Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9, but we're not going to go through it verse by verse today. But listen to the story and think now that you're reporters for the New York Times. And what you have to do is write a story about what you see on the last page of these children's books coming off the ark. And what would you title your story? What would be the headline of your story?
One day God looked down on the earth, and all God saw was the wickedness of human beings. And God regretted having created human beings, and God's heart was saddened. So God decided to wipe all living things off the face of the earth. But there was one righteous man named Noah, blameless in his time, who walked with God. God said to Noah, "The earth is filled with violence, and I will destroy it. Make yourself an ark of wood. Make it with reeds. Cover it with pitch. And bring your wife and your sons and your sons' wives inside this ark. And bring two of every living creature." Noah did as God commanded. He loaded in every sort of fowl, cattle, and creeping thing, clean and unclean, two by two, male and female. They came into Noah's ark. And on the seventh day, the floodgates of the sky and the fountains of the earth burst open. And for 40 days and 40 nights it rained, until the mountains of the earth were covered with swirling waters, and all life outside the ark was dead, and every living creature drowned. But God remembered Noah. God made a wind pass over the earth, and the waters subsided, and the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. Noah released a raven, and it flew back and forth, but found no dry land. Then Noah sent out a dove, and when it returned with an olive leaf, Noah knew the flood was over. God spoke to Noah and said, "You and your wife and your sons' wives must leave the ark. Bring all the living creatures with you." And Noah entered the ark and built an altar and made burnt offerings to God. And the Lord smelled a sweet smell and said, "Never again will I destroy all living creatures or doom the earth because of man." And God said to Noah and his family, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth." A rainbow appeared in the clouds, and God said to Noah, "My bow shall serve as a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When rain clouds gather, I will see the bow and remember the covenant with Noah." God blessed Noah and blessed his sons, Ham, Shem, and Yafet. And Noah planted a vineyard. He drank the wine, got drunk, and lay naked in his tent. And Ham, his son, looked at his father's nakedness, but his two brothers turned their faces away and covered him with a garment. And when Noah woke from his drunken sleep and realized what Ham had done, he cursed the son of Ham, Canaan, saying, "Damned be Canaan, he shall be a servant of the servants to his brothers." And Noah blessed Shem and Yafet and lived 350 years after the flood.
You know, it's really a terrible story.
That's what I was thinking too, isn't that awful?
So your headline would be "A Terrible Story." Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's amazing how much we remember, not from the text, but we remember from that's a positive statement, I guess. The power of children's books. So, what would you call this? What would you, if you were writing the headline for what you just heard? What would you write?
God's second mistake.
God's second mistake. And the first one was
creating man.
Yeah. Okay, a couple others. God's disappointment. One more.
Devastation. Disaster.
Okay, you had one over here?
DUI voter curses son.
DUI voter curses son.
Daughters that get involved in this story.
They're good kids.
Not yet. Give it time.
It's all the sons.
It's all the sons, right. And there's reasons for that, but it has nothing to do, well, with children's story.
I know that they can miss Papa at the end is not what we get to, but it's interesting because nakedness and Adam and Eve, and
that's interesting. I never put that together, but I'm sure there are many other things where you're starting this. It's the second creation over right. again. Noah, yeah. by the way, is the first person born right after Adam dies. Noah, if you're into the genealogy stuff and you list all the generations stuff, Noah comes right smack in the middle between Adam and Abraham. And the be fruitful and multiply you heard here, you're going out, that was the blessing from the first creation. Can we try again? I mean, there's a lot of that, and the nakedness and the shamefulness and covering up and all that. It means that they were still ashamed, maybe. You know, I haven't thought of it that way. That's...
I would defend the children's books in the sense that when you put all these Genesis stories together, what you're getting is the story of this amazing preservation of these totally unworthy creatures. And you navigate the waters between Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel and Noah and all the rest of these people. And the part the children's books tend to raise up is that God has amazing tolerance and allows the experience in hope and joy. And that's the part we want to teach our kids. Now, it's not balanced, but on the other hand, I think it's a very vital part of the story that in the midst of all this, God, I don't think it's any surprise to the Jewish mind that God wipes out these folks.
No.
It's long past deserving. The miracle is that he picks a few and says, let's keep going with the experiment. Mm-hmm.
But even Noah's so overwhelmed afterwards, he gets drunk,
Yeah, that could be one. That's one interpretation. I'm amazed that's the only spot, if you take that interpretation, the whole story, that Noah feels anything. Abraham with Sodom and Gomorrah tries desperately to help, you know, to help his fellow human beings. Noah just builds the ark and, you know, brings in his family, saves his own family, and to hell with the rest of them. That's righteousness, by the way. He's a righteous.
He's obedient.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, right, right. And righteousness can mean many, many different things. But the one thing that, all my notes are messed up here. Righteousness means it is about doing what needs to be done when called on. And definitely, Noah did what he was supposed to do when called on. He built this blooming little box called an ark in the middle of some dry land and waited for rain.
What's the difference between that and obedience?
Well, let's put it this way. Any of you seen Schindler's List?
Yes.
Yes.
The original name for that was Schindler's Ark. Now, Oscar Schindler would not be called a righteous man. Oscar Schindler would have been one of the wicked ones. He was the womanizer, he was the drunk, he was the, he was the person who just kind of did everything and anything and all these sorts of things. But somehow, he protected and saved a lot and a lot and a lot of people. And my haunting question is, who is closer to doing what I would like to think is God's will, a Noah or an Oscar? You can say one thing or the other, but having said, I don't think this story is about Noah. This story, Noah doesn't change at all. I think Noah is as wicked. I think Noah was a drunk before. I just think God said, I got to start with somebody here. The point is that humans, God's creation, aren't what God intended them to be, and they never will be. They never will be.
That's why Jesus came.
Well, thank God. As somebody else says, how do you live with this story? He's like, well, I know how the story ends.
You along that line, the most fascinating thing to me about the story has been that the very thing that makes God destroy the world is the very reason for not doing it again. And that's, I discovered this while you guys reading it, but in chapter 6, verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts were only evil continually. They're dumb. They don't get it. I'm going to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
And then over in the end of chapter 8, verse 21, the Lord says, I will never again curse the ground because of humankind, for the inclination of the human heart is evil from their youth. They're dumb. They don't get it. How can I hit them? You know? I mean,
yeah, they're still, yeah, right, right. Yeah. And you notice, what was the same, what was the words in there all the time? Did you hear the word heart, heart, heart?
Mm-hmm.
They were evil in their heart. I grieve this in my heart.
Yeah.
God has a heart.
God does have a heart. Have any of you read, and I wish, once again, I would have thought of this besides 10 o'clock last night, but Nathaniel Hawthorne's short story, The Holocaust? It's a wonderful little story that says, you know, this world is wicked. This world is terrible. What we need to do with this world is make it better. So let's get rid of everything you can possibly think of that is evil. Okay. And so this is someplace in Kansas, you know, I think, or Nebraska or something. And they start throwing all these things that they think are here. Let's get all the liquid bottles. Let's get all the automobiles, televisions, all these bad books. And they light this fire. And it's a big, huge bonfire. And they start dancing around, and almost some sort of purifying chant, you know. Oh, now we will be made pure. Now we will live a life worthy, da-da-da-da-da-da. Then there's this little cynic who's probably Hawthorne himself in this story. He's like, you've forgotten one thing. The human heart. Put the heart on the fire, and then you will be pure. Which means it ain't going to happen, right? There's no way with all the... that's why I put the whole flood stuff here in parentheses. That's not about the story. The story is there is the creation of God that we followed in the first two chapters of Genesis has run amok. They're not following God's plan. It is not told. It is not what it's meant to be. Now what's going to happen? There's all sorts of evil. There's all sorts of problems. What's the word he uses? What is God going to do?
Blot out.
I'm going to blot out. I created this, and it was tov, it was beautiful. Now, I'm going to blot it all out.
And I am sorry that I made them.
That's a wonderful phrase. One thing, it takes seriously the sinfulness of humankind. God is not going to mix words here. There is something going on here. This is a complete reversal of the creation story that we just heard. That God had declared the whole world was very good, and now God is saying, I'm going to blot it out. I have determined, he said this in 13, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. Now I am going to destroy them along with the earth. Creation has refused to be God's creation. Refused to honor God as God. They've denied their real character. It's a shocking moment. God the creator becomes God the destroyer.
You said that God was upset with Noah, but Noah had found favor in the eyes of God. Noah was a righteous man.
I don't know if I said that God was upset with Noah. I just said that Noah wasn't any better than anybody else, which implies that God could have been upset with him too. But the word righteous does not necessarily mean right living. It could mean right living. But As I said, it means doing what needs to be done when called on, is how I want to define this righteousness. In this sense, Noah is that person. Noah can follow through in the pinch. And as that Holden Lenten time, as he follows through, the thing that bothers me is he's inside in this nice little safe haven, let's call this the Ark. All the world out there is being destroyed. And Noah just, it's not in the text. We don't know how Noah felt about it. The most compassionate thing possibly is that afterwards he got drunk. You know, which means maybe he felt something. You know, I don't know. You know what the number one problem in the world today? Robert Lifton said this years ago. He calls it psychological numbing. That in order to survive in this world, we have to be numb. We just can't go on feeling. And so we go inside our own arcs and shut the world off. And what happens to those people out there? Those people out there are the wicked people. Those people out there are the bad people. I'm the good person inside the ark. You are the bad people out there. You homeless people, you're just a bunch of drunks. You know how we point fingers and we demonize them?
This story of the ark and people beating at the door to come in reminds me of some of the films we had in the early 60s with the time of the nuclear threats and bomb shelters were being built. And I think there was a film called Butterflies. It was quite, people closed the doors of their bomb shelters and others let me in, let me in. And we had a neighbor who built a bomb shelter, and we wondered how that would work. He was the only one in the neighborhood who had one.
You're the dentist.
And the children at school were practicing where you're going to send your children, whose home was we going to take them in case we had an air raid. But it was pretty threatening.
Thank you. We had a bomb shelter in our house. My dad built one. He built it with, I think it was 3 feet of concrete above, in the sand outside. You had about 2 or 3 feet of sand on the outside walls. And then you had this little cylinder pipe that goes down in, out for air. Like, that's gonna, you know, nothing else is gonna get in now. You know, and then you're supposed to put this huge door on it. And my dad built all of this, and we saw these types of movies, and we talked about who are we going to let in? Who, you know, if we only have food and water for the four of us, maybe five or six, we might be able to invite 2 people in. Who should we invite in? Who should we keep? We talked this way. But my dad never put the door on it. That about 3-4 years later, maybe it's because I got older and I started wondering about this, I says, Dad, you know, we had all the food that was supposed to be there, everything else. And I said, Dad, why didn't you put the door on? He says, I just can't hate the world. Hmm. He says, it's not a bomb shelter, it's a fruit cellar. Peace conversion project. Your plows into, no, your arms into plowshares. I mean, it's swords into plowshares. Thank you. Bomb shelters into fruit cellars. I wouldn't have thought of that. Thank you. Thank you. Somebody in the first session said the image that she had of this ark is the in Saigon when the helicopters were coming. She says she remembers all these people trying to get to the helicopters or hanging, trying to hang on, take me out of here. And then where is it in here that the doors shut?
I thought it was interesting, he was 600 years old when this happened.
Oh yeah. Somebody in the first session says, did they all live that long back in those days? No, God blotted them all out, but no. I don't know. Age is used that important people live longer.
Yes.
So the more important you are, the longer you live. So you have you have a lot of people getting older, and this is how you embellish stories too. They just go on and on and on, and they become larger than life. It's interesting that this story happens right after the story of Cain and Abel. Am I my brother's keeper? Am I my brother's keeper? Cain says. Does Noah have anything to do with keeping his brothers and sisters out of the ark? No, I guess I'm not supposed to be my brother's keeper. I'm just supposed to take care of my own.
Should he have refused God's instruction and said, look, I'm a human being. If they die, I die. Or should he have been the pilot of the bomb in Hiroshima?
I would want a third alternative. I would want the same alternative that what Abraham tried with Sodom and Gomorrah. I would at least like to have seen Noah plead with God and argue with God a little bit. Why there must be somebody else that is righteous like me. You know, can't we look and can I just try to find one or two more? You know, there's just none of that. But you know, the story is not about Noah, it's about God, and that's how I get out of that trap.
I think that's why he was chosen.
Pardon?
Because he wouldn't argue.
That old Norwegian proverb comes around. Noah was one of these Norwegians who just shut up and adjusted.
We have some evolutionary progress from the time of Noah to the time of Abraham.
My question is, for me, it's a story about, it's not so much about God, but about human projections onto God. We felt so badly, we finally got it, that we were messing up. And we put because of our guilt, we put this sorrow onto God, you know, that we should be punished. That it's just a big projection, a human projection about who God is. And that's, now looking back, well, that's how it was then, but when this was orally passed down and written down, but I don't know how much it's about God. And then what about that piece that says that Noah was righteous because he lived in the presence, or he was with, what's that phrase? I can't remember.
Anybody have it there?
The reason that he was righteous was because...
It just says he was blameless in his generation and he walked with God.
He walked with God. So there's got to be some notion that there is the ability of humans to be connected with God, intimately connected, even though we mess up in big ways.
Yeah, I agree. But the one thing I don't agree with is that I don't want Noah to be perfect. I don't want Noah to be just this, as we know, at least I normally consider what righteousness is, because if it means that Noah is the saint, it means I'm the sinner, and I'm too good a Lutheran. I know that saint and sinner live in all of us at the same time. And if it's up to me, if it's up to Noah to save the world, it ain't gonna happen, because it didn't happen with Adam, it didn't happen with Eve. But if it's up to God, then there is hope.
But Darius, it's not a Lutheran story, it's a Jewish story. And for the Jews...
Oh, they're all good. No.
For the Jews, yeah. You can be righteous. Your righteousness doesn't save the world, but it gives an avenue through which God can do God's work. So the fact that Noah doesn't question, is righteous, can walk with God, has this holy life, this sanctified life, is the fact that God can then use him to do his work. So. My Lutheran fear is that, well, if I say I can be good, then I think I'm going to pop into heaven because I'm good. Jews say, no, you can be good because you can be good.
Right.
If everybody was good at the same time, we pop into heaven. That's not going to happen. But you can be good,
yep.
And then God can work through you. So, what's wrong with Noah being good or righteous or wrong with God?
What's wrong with him being a drunkard and having moments when he can walk with God?
There's nothing wrong with that. I'm saying both exists in Noah, and that's, I think that's what you're saying too. Over here and then over here.
Well,
yes.
I just wanted to share that in my Bible version,
Genesis 6:8 indicates that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord.
Grace, it says here, favor. What does yours say? Anybody have grace? Well, God, yeah, found acceptance. Yeah, so.
Deserving that he was not, he still found the grace.
And in that sense, that's very good. It doesn't mean that you're this perfect human being. This means that God is gracing you. God is showing favor on you. Whether it's deserved or not, it's not there.
Not the question.
Yeah.
Yeah, there. I've studied this once before. I don't know.
Oh, good. Tell me the answer.
But I understand there are two flood accounts.
Yes.
And this in 6, verse 11 and 12, it said, God saw that the earth was corrupt, for all flesh was corrupted in its place here. And God said to Noah, it doesn't say anything about him being righteous or anything else. He just chose Noah to do this. And that's that time of grace, that Noah was chosen to do this by God. And then in the second account in verse 7, or chapter 7, it talks about his righteousness, and that's a different tradition. So you have two different traditions here.
Good point. Like the two creation stories, we had two of them, but they were side by side. This one, it's both J and P again, like we said in day one. They're intermeshed. And sometimes they're intermeshed the same sentence, if you want to believe the scholars. In mid-sentence, it goes to the other account. And we know this, once again, by having words like God and having words like Lord in our RSV. One is one account, one is the other. And a couple examples of those differences is that in the J account, where it says, Lord, you have, you don't have two of every kind that come onto the ark. You have two of every kind of the unclean animals, the lions, for example. But you have seven pairs of the clean animals, which means, you know, you needed them for sacrifice, so you needed a few more of them, probably. So you have in one account, you have two by two, the other one you have some two by two, and you have others that go seven by, well, yeah, seven by seven, or two by two seven times, however you say that. One account, it rains for 40 days. The other account, and you got to do some math here and all that, because it tells how old Noah is and all this months and all that. But you basically get to 370 days it rained. So you have 40 days, or you have 370 days. One account, and here's where it really, and you heard it on the tape here. One account is the dove, and one account it's a raven. But how they mix that in the same sentence is you send out the raven, and the raven comes back, and then you send out a dove, and the dove comes back with an olive branch. And one's account of the other. So that helps the story a little bit, and it confuses the story a lot.
But the sense that he was only chosen because he's righteous, the first account just says he was just chosen by God, which
right.
is a graceful act.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, as I look at this whole thing, but the relationship between God and humankind, and I can understand the human Noah representing all of us, you know, as being simple. What I can't understand is God here. I can't understand God creating human beings, knowing in God's God being God in creation that this might end up the way they would be. Having known that, and then starting all over again. That's something doesn't quite fit there, you know, if you go way back to the beginning. And then God said, I'm just wondering about this. And then, okay, let's start this thing all over, but I promise I'll never do this again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it's a long time before Jesus comes. So what's going on there?
This is his first creation, and he's learning.
But not a very good nurturing parent, would you say, Ms. Nurturer? she's been speaking about nurturing.
But he's finding the boundaries.
Yeah.
Figuring out what the boundaries should
be. Yeah, right. Okay, one, two, and then three.
Well, you know, I do think this is sort of a story about parenting, you know, that God parenting us and
punishing us for wickedness. And you also have Noah punishing his child for wickedness. Okay, and they both seem quite harsh to me. I mean, you know, he's destroying a lot of lives, God is, in the flood. And Noah is cursing his own son for looking on himself when he himself was, you know, kind of created the problem by getting drunk and being naked. I mean, if he had been behaving himself in the first place, Ham would never have seen him naked and he would never have been cursed, you know. And you're kind of wondering about God setting up the world the way it was. He sort of brought this up upon the earth in a way by creating us the way we were. And yet he's punishing us for our wickedness.
Well, we ate us.
That's kind of, I see it as a story of punishment.
Walter Brueggemann, who's a mentor of mine in this whole Genesis stuff, says that we could have a different God. There are different flood accounts, there are different stories. We could invent God in our own image, if we wish. But this is the God we have. This is the God we must struggle with to understand. This is the only God we have if we believe in the Judeo-Christian God. And I'll tell you what I think about that, but I know I'm number three and you were one. Who is the other? Over here. Yeah.
Well, this is probably a gross simplification.
Oh, good. I need it, though. Gross simplification.
So many of the stories in the Old Testament, and this one included, is a testimonial of God's eternal wish for us to love him back. And he never gives up on that wish or that hope, whatever you want to say. God being God, God is good, God is love, God is always, everything that is perfection is God. And here he created this perfect world and really, really wishing, really hoping that we would stay with him. And we went the other way. And it's always this wooing back. And it's always been curious to me that when he did the flood thing, why he saved Noah and his family. Why didn't he just wipe them out too and start all over with another perfect man? Mm-hmm. But he still helped, just like he held that hope that this man, and again, we're talking about this genetic thing that we've been hearing too this week, you know, that with all those bad genes, the whole thing, he really believed somehow, wished in his heart that in this man there would be hope again, that it would go good.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's
and I think it's a profound simplification, which is, I mean, not profoundly simplified, but it's right on the mark, because God knows, I mean, let's put it this way, that these stories are stories we must remember. We keep wanting to think of them as historical fact. And what they are trying to point out truths that are much larger than historical truths. And the truth that this points out, I think, number one, that humans will always do good and bad. That even though God intended us to be this wonderful creation that will just be beautiful, something, free will, evil, what, bad luck, whatever, it's in our genes, it's run amok. But what God sees, and we're back to your question, what I think God is all about is that God does grow up here. God changes. Humans don't. We read this story, we read the Old Testament all too often thinking that human beings are supposed to change. And we're supposed to. But God can't count on that. So God's got to figure out how God has got to change. And if we think and start thinking, and this is why I think, thank God, the Judeo world is a part of the Christian world. If we think that God is omnipotent, all-knowing, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, we have a real problem with this text. But I see God as a God who's trying to figure out
how can this world work? With all this evil, with all this hostility, with all this pain, I gotta just get rid of all this stuff. And that's what it does here. And then, somebody read 8:1.
God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and all the domestic animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided.
Now, that's the pivotal, I think, verse in this whole account. God remembers. I'm not a destroyer God. I'm a creating God. I'm not a God of wrath and vengeance. I'm not a God of evil. I am a God who wants people to know who I am. I remember Noah and all those living things. I know all of creation. And so God has the waters subside here. And God makes then, this is wrapping this up quick so we can just throw the thing open. God makes a new commitment. I'm not going to be that kind of God. I'm not going to destroy the whole world again. You are wicked. You are terrible. You are a bunch of losers.
Most of the time.
But I'm going to stick with you. What happens here is not a lesson on how we can become better. But the lesson, which I wish would be in some children's books, that no matter how we are, God is with us. God will stick by us through thick and thin. It is remembering which changes the situation of the world from hostility to commitment. And the great story, and I think it's, is it verse 21 where it says, never again? I will never again curse the ground because of humankind, for the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth. Nor will I ever again destroy every living creature as I have done. God says, never again. They remind you of some other times that people have shouted, never again? About the Holocaust? Never again. That's not just coincidental. I think they know this story. They understand this. Never again. Not only does God remember that, but we have to remember that. Never again. The flood has effected no change in humankind whatsoever. But it has effected an irreversible change in God. That's what I had to say. Now I want to get back to all the frustrations and all the problems, and I don't have to worry about the time in getting that in. This story isn't about the flood. The story is about God understanding what God has to do because of our hearts. And thank God, God can figure that out.
Does this go back to the Genesis account of what God was looking for when he created humans in the first place? I want some type of companionship here. God am lonely and unhappy. And I'm waffling between creating something which is God-like, that knows the difference between right and wrong because I want spark. I even see God going through a corrective program. Adam turns out to be sort of a dull clod and is almost incapable of getting into trouble. So God creates something that's got spark and imagination and
I am woman.
And promptly gets trouble. And now God's going through that process again. I was lonely and I still will be lonely. I want something between Adam and Eve in creation. I am not quite sure how to work that out yet. Man is being called upon to be sort of a co-creator, if I can use that sort of terminology.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try and shape something here that will have the spark of Eve and the stability of Adam, if I can put it that way without arousing any feelings. Thank you, son.
Mom in the middle.
It seems to me that's what's going on. God is saying, you know, I blew it in creation, I blew it again. I've got to blow up.
I'm reminded of the book Dance of Anger, and it's sort of like God's going through this process of, I'd like to be in relationship. And I try this part of my dance and it doesn't work and I become angry because even though, I mean, I'm trying not to control, I really am. I really want them to be, you know, be in relationship with me, but this dance isn't working and I'm angry and, you know, yeah, I could destroy them, but then I have no relationship at all. So how do I change what I'm doing? And it seems like the human situation all through the text is chronic low self-esteem, you know?
Yep.
It's amazing how many people that I have listened to in my office and other places who tell stories like this. I used to have all these dreams about my kids. They were going to grow up and be this Nobel Prize winner, this pro baseball player, this nuclear physicist, or at least something. And now I'm afraid. I'm afraid that all my dreams that I thought they would be happening are not happening. I mean, he or she is just blowing it. It seems like they don't have any spark. They're just doing this or that or this. Or some people, they start changing their expectations. And I once wanted my kid to get his PhD. I once wanted my kid to graduate from college. I once wanted my kid to go to college. I once wanted my kid to graduate from high school. But now I want my kid to be a decent human being. We go through changing expectations as parents. And I think God's in the same world with us, and I think God is starting to understand here that I guess it's the parent who has to do the changing.
I have a comment.
Sure.
I am not a Jew, mm-hmm. and I was not a Christian. I don't know whether I am now, but I am baptized about 10 years ago. So the tradition I came from, that sets me up as a God. It's not the one we are talking about. The God is something more, something bigger, something we cannot see, but we have to see every day. We have to feel every day. So when that's why I'm trying to put myself into the Christian's point and Jew's point to see, to understand what is in that Bible. To be frank with you, I don't read Bible because that's minimizing my sense of God. And to try to confine and claustrophobic God. Mm-hmm. So when I see people, I go to church very regularly, but we build the ark that called the church. And we are voluntarily being claustrophobic with this God we can interpret. but not beyond that. But so that's why I'm struggling with, but I'm very happy with it as well, the way I am proceeding.
J.B. Phillips wrote a teeny little book years ago that says, Your God is Too Small. That one of the big dangers we have, I think, is to think that we know who God is. But God is always larger than our conception of God. But that doesn't mean we cannot have a conception of God, that we have to start somewhere. And I would encourage you, it may feel claustrophobic at times, but when I read Scripture, I'm amazed at the new understandings I get of God, how bigger God gets, not smaller God gets. There are times where I feel in church that God is becoming very small and we are controlling God and we know who and what God is. And God always has a way of upsetting that. Because, you know, Sally McFagan, in her book, Models of God, says we always have to break open the metaphor. We always got to think about God in new and different ways. So she talks about God as lover, God as parent, God as friend. We just constantly got to be throwing in more and more metaphors to open up our conception of God. So in that sense, I totally agree with you that most of our images of God is way too small. And way too restricted. God is woman. God is, as somebody said, visualize God as a black paraplegic lesbian. You know, try it, see where it goes. You know, or God is none of that. God is not human at all. God is beyond our anthropomorphizing of God. Too, you know, God is all of that and none of that all the time. And that's what's exciting to me about it, and that's what's also frustrating to me about it.
It seems to make sense when you look at the world that God is a God that changes and can adapt, because that's what the world is like. You know, there's changing genetic mutations, all those kinds of things all the time. So it seems that a God who changes and adapts.
However, I did ask Ted Peters about the genetic mutations, and he said when they mutate, they only mutate to go downhill. Mm-hmm. They don't mutate to get stronger and better. Mm-hmm. It only gets worse and worse and worse. So I don't know what that is, but I was wondering that question, so I asked him that last night. Yes.
I agree with what you said, but it's a both and for me. And that is, I think the claustrophobia is a very important part. It's just like a marriage for me. There is more life, more depth, more anything in my spouse than I can ever imagine. You know, but I will never get to any of it if I'm not locked up in the same relationship in the same house and have to deal with it. Which feels like a minimizing. I mean, to make a commitment feels like
claustrophobic.
It feels, marriage feels claustrophobic. Family feels claustrophobic. This stupid kid I've had now, you know, I have so much limited my life because of this child, and I have to deal with this thing all the time. But I think that's the scriptural point. I think that's this point here between God and humanity. Exactly, you've got to deal with it all the time. That's what makes us, that's the security of the relationship. Before I was ordained, we lived in a small town there in Coast Forks, and my wife was a nurse midwife, so we sort of floated between the hippie culture and the church culture, and I became a sort of quasi pastor for the hippies because I was not ordained and so it wasn't real. But
but you never inhaled.
Yeah, I never inhaled. This couple came once and they'd been living together like forever and trying to decide whether you get married and stuff. And so they asked me finally if I'd marry them, and I said I can't. I mean, we worked through that, but the answer was yes, if you'll get a paper signed at the office. But we were having this discussion, my wife, myself, and the two of them. And part of the discussion was, what do you have in mind for the service? And they said, well, we have this sort of Buddhist type thing. And they didn't know what they're talking about, I know what they're talking about. But what they wanted was this sort of
blissful entry into relationship together. And so they were going to have lots of silence meditation stuff, which would be fine. They said, how about your vows? And they finally said, well, we don't want to do vows. What we want is this period of silence. And we'll have a gong, we'll have this period of silence, and then we'll have another gong. And that'll be the spiritual union. My wife gets up and says, you got to say the words. You know, that was their issue, you know. You've got to enter into this thing, you know. Yeah, exactly.
Has something to do with commitment, huh?
And until you do that and are stuck in the relationship until you can't stand it, then you're not going to move through to the growth. And so I think the claustrophobia of the God is an important part of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And I agree with what you said.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot more depth than you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
But what God's doing here to these folks is saying, doggone it, these people are so crummy, I cannot stand it, I'm going to blow them away. And then God remembers and says, no, I committed to them. And because, precisely because they're so scummy, I can't stand it, I got to remember that I'm committed and will stay here.
Two things. You should never get pastors talking about wedding stories because you'll never be able to stop. But when I was the campus pastor at University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, there was this bar down the street called Okie's. And Okie's was a bar, picture a room like this about four times his size, black card tables, black chairs, black floors, black walls, black ceilings. It was dark. It was black. And I got a phone call, and they said, hey, I hear you do weddings. And I says, yeah, I've done a few. Well, we want to get married. I said, well, good. I says, when? They told me the date. I said, well, I'm available. Where? They said, Okie's. That's where we met. And I've been in there once in my life, and I just walked in and walked out, you know. And so I says, well, I've done weddings in parks, I've done weddings at, you know, Bandelier National Monument, I've done weddings in many different places. But I said, I want to let you know that wherever it is for that time, that becomes the place where we invoke the presence of God. Because what weddings is about is that God is blessing this relationship. And they said, well, we don't want any of that religious shit. And I said, excuse me? You're calling me? I said, why are you calling me? He says, well, we tried a lot of other pastors. And they said, try a campus pastor. You can say, in New Mexico, anybody can do weddings. And you just have to go down the next day and have it formalized in the court. So I told them that. Oh, thank you. And they hung up. And that's the last I heard of them. Back to this question, though. I know why I brought this book. It's not in the bookstore. It's $50, so that's probably why it's not in the bookstore. I should have recommended it. It's Everett Fox's new translation. Oh, by the way, Cindy, I did not pay $50. I got it at the AARSBL for 50% off, and Everett Fox actually signed it, so it might be worth more. But it's a new translation of the Pentateuch. And in the translator's preface, he does an adaptation from a lecture of Martin Buber in 1926. Martin Buber wrote I, Thou. It was all about I, it relationships, I, Thou relationship, and I, eternal Thou. That what we're all about is trying to make that connection with that God that is always beyond us. And Buber says this, which I think is powerful to this point. Read the Bible as though it were something entirely unfamiliar, as though it had not been set before you ready-made. Face the book with a new attitude, as something new. Let whatever may happen occur between yourself and it. You do not know which of its sayings and images will overwhelm and mold you. But hold yourself open. Do not believe anything a priori, and do not disbelieve anything a priori. Read aloud the words written in the book in front of you. Hear the word you utter, and let it reach you. It may not be worth $50, but it's at least worth $25. That sentence alone. This, yeah.
One quick point. In my own mind, I think that we question God far too much. The more we try to get intellectual ourselves, the more we try to play God and question, why did God do this and why did God do that? I don't think we should be passive, but on the other hand, we're not doing a very good job of handling our own humanity, let alone trying to handle what God should be handling.
Okay. And I agree, except for I come out with the same conclusion by questioning God a lot. God is big enough to take our questions. Prayer is not thee and thou. Prayer is honest words. If you're madder than heck, you know, don't worry that you might offend God. God can take care of it. You gotta speak from those unutterable groanings. You gotta speak from something that's visceral. And you gotta feel it to such a way that all of a sudden you can see something new here. And to get to that point, I know how, as John Nelson said, pastor in Seattle, who's been a peace activist for years and years and years. The peace movement, you know, things are worse than they were when you started. Why are you wasting all your time with this? And he said, I know how the story ends. The lion will lie down with the lamb, and you shall study war no more.
He's my confirmation pastor.
Well, lucky you. Lucky you. This ends the, quote, prehistory time. Tomorrow we give a brief introduction to Abraham, call, and promise, which then any of you around next week, we will be going through the rest of the Bible. So, excuse me! I tell you, the way I'm trying to do it, it feels like I'm going through the rest. It's only Genesis. So. It's in your genes. Genesis and genes, by the way, they have something to do.